Welcome. For years, I was on the inside. I saw how power really works, how decisions are made, how secrets are kept. Then I exposed the truth about the deep state, and the deep state tried to ruin my life. But they failed. Because the American people deserve to know who is pulling the strings and why. This isn't theory, it's experience. My experience. I'm John Kiriakou. This is The Deep State. I want to bring on now Jay Dyer. Jay is a well-known YouTuber, a Christian apologist, a theologian, and podcaster. He discusses topics from Christianity to geopolitics to the deep state. Yeah, I wrote myself a note as you were speaking, because you made me think that maybe there are lessons that we can learn from the Byzantine Empire. It failed in the end, but what lessons do you think can be drawn from this historical relationship between the church and the empire? They were two separate things with separate leaderships, but they were one as part of the nation state. Is that practical in today's world?
Well, this is probably the thing that would most go against the grain of everything that people think, right? This idea that there could be a synergy or a symphonia between church and state is very antithetical to everything after the Enlightenment, and with good reason, because in my view, the papacy was very abusive to this, idea of the separation of powers. It's not that there was this supposedly separation of church and state, but depending on what you mean by that, basically there's a sphere that the church is involved in, and there's a sphere of life that the state's involved in, and there might be some overlap there, but they're two heads of the same body of the Byzantine eagle is the idea. So I think that there will always be a tendency to move in that direction, because in my view, there's no such thing as a purely neutral view of the world. And other religions like Islam, they don't see a separation between the sacred and the secular, or at least they don't tend to. The more orthodox Muslims don't tend to see it that way. And a lot of people in the West, I think, would see that as a weakness, but they might actually be a strength, because it allows their people to really push their religion in every area of life. And I think people in the West are going to have to make a decision between a type of Christianity that is all-encompassing and does have an impact on the civil state, or they're going to have to choose something like that, because the Enlightenment idea of everybody having a kind of almost deistic Freemasonic Enlightenment principle of, well, we can all just agree that we should have freedom of religion, freedom of speech, these sort of negative liberties, I just don't think that's going to work in the future to give adequate place for the relationship of church and state. I think that people are going to be getting to say, well, wait a minute. So I've got Christianity over here. If Christianity, so-called, is telling me that the state should be atheistic and secular, but privately I can have my own private Christianity. And then I've got Islam over here, where God is, Allah is the Lord of area of life. Mm-hmm. Well, this kind of makes a little more sense than this idea that God is only the Lord of your personal life, but he has nothing to do with the state. This is literally, I don't know how people in America and the West came to this conclusion, especially in the Orthodox world. This is like Quakerism. This is Roger Williams' Baptist stuff. It blows my mind that the whole history of the church is, an idea, at least, of symphonia once the church was no longer persecuted after Constantine and Theodosius. I tend to take a pretty, unpopular stance that Americanism is not necessarily the history of Orthodox Christianity.
When I was studying Islam in college, literally the first thing that we were taught was that Islam is a religion, but not just a religion. It's also a social construct. It's an economic system. It's a way of life. It's everything.
It's law. It's also a whole theory.
And it's also law. That's exactly right. How do you think Orthodox Christians should view economic systems, capitalism, socialism, communism? Is there a role for Orthodox philosophy in secular economic systems?
Yes. And but I want to be clear that for us, I think the way that we should, so we talked earlier about dialectics, right?
Yeah.
And false choices. So a lot of times what happens, people think, they'll say, well, you either love Jesus and you follow the spiritual stuff, or you're in the world, right? Mm-hmm. Well, not everybody is a monastic. Not everybody is called to that life. So many of us, most of us, are going to be in the world. And so it's possible to have, number one, you know, the religious priorities, if you're a believing Orthodox Christian, that's your higher priority, right? You can also have other interests and things that you do in the world where you apply those principles in the world without sacrificing that being the number one. And that's because in Orthodox metaphysics, I don't want to get too out here, but we believe, contrary to a lot of the medieval Latin theology, that there's actually a multiplicity of goods. In other words, if you chose to be single or to be celibate, that doesn't make married life bad mm-hmm. or evil.
That's right.
It just means perhaps that it's a lesser good, okay? But there's nothing inherently wrong with lesser goods. But in a lot of medieval and ancient and Augustinian ideology, it's always a presentation of a false either or. Well, either you choose the good path of celibacy or you choose an evil path of being married. And Augustine even himself said at times that he even though he had to admit that marriage was a sacrament, he said he could never understand how it would be possible that marital union could be a sacrament, because for him it always necessitated some degree of sin. He says that in City of God. And I'm just using it as an example to say, now, this is misunderstanding that in the Orthodox metaphysic, there are multiple goods, right? Creation is good. It's not the highest good, but it's still a good. And the fact that it's not the highest good doesn't make it an evil, right? So
that's right.
Yes, there can be application of these principles to economics. Economics itself is not evil, but it's not the highest good. Philosophy, right, can be done right, can be done well. There are countless famous Byzantine philosophers. You know, some of the greatest saints in the Orthodox Church, like Saint Photius, they were the most learned men in their times in Byzantium. So there's nothing inherently wrong with academia or scholasticism or economics or whatever. I think that in my view, that there are a lot of insights that Austrian economics has. There's some positives there, also have some criticisms there. I mean, I'm a promoter. I do believe Bitcoin is good. I think it's ethical money. But I wouldn't say that that's necessarily, right, like tied to my Orthodox faith. I don't judge a person, you know, if they don't believe in Bitcoin or whatever. But, and I'm not at all a socialist or a communist or a Marxist, but I do think there should be kind of critique or a limit on where Austrian economics could go crazy I think it could lead to a form of monopoly capitalism. I know that most of them would say it doesn't, but I think that it potentially could. So there's got to be some relationship between limitations in regard to an authority or a state versus the freedom of the market. Otherwise you get rampant, you know, corporatism and just sort of corporate control of all society, which is really not a whole lot different from a top-down sort of communist control. So, you know, I had a debate, it's funny you said that, I won't keep yapping, but I had a debate with Tim Pool, the live stream host a month ago. And this was exactly the topic we debated. He said, company towns, there's nothing wrong with that. Right. There's nothing, there's no slavery. You're free to come or go. Well, none of that's actually true. In a company town, you have to use the company tokens and the company bucks. Right. And so I'm just using a company town as an example of where capitalism could conceivably be almost like kind of a communist dictator. So I think that there has to be checks and balances on any of these, you know, post-Enlightenment systems. And that includes capitalism, libertarianism, or socialism and Marxism.
In 2006, I had occasion to visit Mount Athos in northeastern Greece. For those of our viewers who don't know about Mount Athos, it's a monastic community. It's exempt from many of the laws and regulations of the European Union in that it's a place that houses 31 monasteries. Women are not permitted. When female animals are found, they're actually removed from the mountain. And you're only allowed to go for up to 4 days and 3 nights. You're only allowed to spend one night at each of the monasteries where you elect to stay. And it's tough to get there. They allow 100 Orthodox Christians and 10 non-Orthodox Christians per day. You have to get a religious visa. in the town of Uranopoli, which is right outside the border of the Holy Mountain. Anyway, my point here is that as recently as 50 years ago, Manathos was a dying area. Many of the monasteries were abandoned. They had fallen into disuse. And I'm talking about monasteries that go back to the 10th century. Now, Mount Athos is flourishing. And it's not just, you know, Greek. I would say it's not even majority Greek. It's maybe a plurality. But there are Russians and Serbs and Romanians and Bulgarians and Syrians and Americans and Orthodox from every nation that has Orthodox. What do you attribute this success to? Why is monasticism becoming so much more popular now than it was just as recently as a half a century ago?
Probably a lot of factors. I know that probably amongst young men, I've met many young men who are interested in and are moving into and have gone into monasticism over the last 6 or 7 years of, you know, kind of me being out here doing stuff. And that would probably be attributable to a lot of wild things going on in the modern world in terms of what's being promoted, sort of extreme levels of degeneracy, not just being out there. We've always had trans people and this kind of stuff, but not really from it being promoted from the top down, at least not in the modern era. So I think those things shock people. They probably motivate people to want to take, you know, their Christianity and their devotion to the next level. And I think a lot of guys, and this might be a big one that's really difficult to deal with. A lot of guys are having a hard time in the male-female department. Everything right now is really weird. And I was single and in the dating world 10 years ago. And even then, it was getting pretty crazy. And nowadays, when I talk to young guys and who are in that world, and when you see stuff, you know, online, it just seems to be completely insane. It's just, we've never really seen in the modern world this kind of a breakdown of just kind of basic guy-girl stuff. And even when I talk to older people, you know, boomer generation people or even Gen X people, and I'm on that cusp of millennial and Gen X, so I can kind of bridge this gap, it's very difficult to explain to them that it's not like it was, you know, in the 1980s, 70s, you go out, you court a girl, you ask her out. It's way different now. A lot of the younger girls have been completely brainwashed. They have TikTok brain rot. Yes. And so you can't form a pair bond of a possible future family, which many guys want, but also the guys have been sort of stunted into a kind of arrested development. They're stuck in neoteny. They don't want to grow up. So there's a lot of things going on. And I would guess that that's probably a huge factor. I don't know about Athos, but I would guess in America, a lot of guys probably think, well, you know, in Orthodoxy have the path of being married or have the path of monasticism. There's not a whole lot of tradition or push for people just sort of remaining single. I'm sure that that's happened at some point, but most people are sort of counseled to enter married life or to enter monasticism. And my guess would be that the insanity of what's going on between men and women, a lot of which I think is by design, a lot of it's the effect of the internet. There's a lot of different factors, but I would say that's probably a big indicator as to why guys in America might be considering and choosing monasticism.
Stay with us, Jay. We're going to take a short break and come right back. When we come back, we will have more with Jay Dyer. I'm John Kiriakou, and this is The Deep State. Stay right there. Welcome back to The Deep State. I'm John Kiriakou. We're joined back again today by our guest, Jay Dyer, podcaster, theologian, and expert debater. Thanks so much for being with us, Jay. I want to hit on a couple of other topics that are important in the contemporary Orthodox Church. One of the things that the Greek Orthodox are especially proud of is the position of Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew on environmental issues, to the point where for decades he's been known as the Green Patriarch. What role do you think Orthodox Christianity has in environmental protection? And do you see it as being universal across the churches?
This is another tough, John, you're really good at these nuanced, tough questions. no easy questions from John Kriok, which is good for an interview. So I tend to be pretty critical of the green movement and the green agenda because there's a good book I read some years back by a woman named Rosa Corey. And she's a little out there, but she has some really good, I think, critiques of this perspective. I think that, again, there's got to be some kinds of ethical and legal limitations on what corporations can do because, you know, for one, if we really cared about, this is similar to the hypocrisy with Saudi Arabia, like if we really cared about the environment and we cared about, you know, health, then we wouldn't have had GMOs. We would have listened to the type of critiques that RFK Jr. makes now about our terrible food supply a long time ago. And the green agenda, maybe at times and early on, like they might have had some of those types of critiques, but nowadays it's not that. I think it's pretty much a corporate agenda. Mm-hmm. It's on board with a lot of the, you know, United Nations, World Economic Forum types of agendas, which I think are ultimately tied into a kind of depopulation ethos. It's about austerity. It's about corporate control. It's not about the environment. I think that if it was about the environment and health, we would have again had we would have had similar ideas about food that Europe has. Like, I'll give you an anecdotal example. Like, I can't eat American dairy or pasta. I mean, it just ruins my stomach. But I spent 2 weeks in Italy on a Orthodox pilgrimage. I could eat anything I wanted. So I don't know about the bureaucracy. I'm not a fan of the EU, but like they have at least an idea that food should actually be food. Okay. In America, we have corporate just processed nonsense, which destroys the gut. And I'm not trying to get off into health stuff, but that's an example to me of, well, if the green agenda was really about the environment and about health, it would be about that. It would have a pro-human attitude. It would not have an anti-natalist perspective, and it's almost always wrapped up with anti-natalism. So I would say that to me, that suggests that unfortunately, Patriarch Bartholomew has a lot of other interests that he answers to, probably other than putting theology first. Mm-hmm. And I know that's probably true for a lot of bishops and patriarchs. They have to deal with the politics of the church. They have to deal with the state. It's complex, it's nuanced, but I really feel like, and I mean, you can make similar criticisms of Patriarch Kirill too in certain ways, but I think that when it comes to the green agenda, I definitely think it's a corporate scam in my view.
And what about media, especially global media or homogenization of media? What do you think the Orthodox response should be to that?
You know, I have some friends that are starting up some Orthodox outlets. Logos Media is a new thing that's popping up.
Yeah,
impressive. I didn't expect doing this sort of stuff on a YouTube channel that we would have the effect that we've had over the last 8 years. So this is all kind of blossoming and burgeoning as a snowball, kind of unexpected.
There's a thirst for it. That's why we need people like you talking about these issues. People are flocking to you because they believe that you have the answer to these questions. They need to hear what you have to say.
And all I have to do is just give a confident, assertive appearance of knowing the answers. And no, I'm joking.
There you go.
I don't know the answers. I know some answers, perhaps, but you know, all I'm saying there is just that, you know, we began really just kind of doing debates for fun and, you know, doing silly stuff on YouTube for fun. And it sort of turned into something that we didn't expect. So I think the more Orthodox content creators should come about. I'd like to see that. I'd like to see them doing it on their own. I don't think the future is the legacy system or going back to some sort of network style. People can do that if they want. They can mimic it or whatever. But the future is what we're doing right here. The future is now. This is what is the future. We're doing it. This is it. So absolutely. And by the way, in 2017, 18, when we really started doing debates and talking about a lot of theology, there were hardly any Orthodox YouTube channels or Orthodox priests or content creators. There was a handful. I think Patricia Nectar was around. There was Father Peter Hears, but there was not many. Okay. And then we started talking about it just on the side for fun. And now it's everywhere. So, and by the way, I've seen in the last month, probably 5 to 10 YouTube channels of Protestants saying, I'm going to Orthodoxy.
Wow.
So this is really having an effect. And I think the key is to not fall into thinking that it needs to be a corporate thing, because I was talking to Father Moses the other day, his channel, Moses McPherson out of Austin, his channel's blown up to 200,000 subscribers within a couple years. And they just sit in the back of his house or in the back of the church, and they just have a little, you know, interview. And technology's cheap now. You can do this on your own. So that's the future, is doing what we're doing.
Wow. I want to ask you, too, about artificial intelligence. Does the Orthodox Church have a position on AI? Should the Orthodox Church have a position on AI? Or maybe even a better way to ask it would be, is there a way for the Orthodox Church to use AI?
I remember one time, I'm not a huge fan of Father Alexander Schmemann, but I remember one time I read a thing of him saying that he was tempted by thinking that maybe the Amish were right, that electricity was demonic. I always thought that was funny. But I would say probably something similar. I think that in time we begin to recognize and receive the idea that, well, you know, it's kind of omnipresent and it seems like it's here to stay. So I don't think it's the devil's creation. I mean, AI is a complex one because there are potentialities that it could ruin society. I'm not an expert in this area. I can give just my opinions. I think that it could be a dangerous thing that could really, it's going to replace a lot of people's jobs, obviously. But also I wonder if it might also partly be a fad, because a lot of the art, a lot of the stuff that it does, it's kind of slop. You know, everybody calls it AI slop.
Yes.
So I feel like people will always want real human musicians, real human art. I don't think they're going to want to just see the same, you know, easily reproducible AI materials. So my guess would be that probably there is a way for Orthodox to have, because really for me, and I think even at most people at this stage, and maybe the Pentagon has something 10 times crazier that's 20 years ahead of us, I don't know. But what we have right now is really just a kind of a search engine that talks back to you and gets half of the things wrong.
Yes.
So,
yes,
like,
indeed.
It doesn't, it's not that impressive so far. It could be in the future. It could be something dangerous, but I would say that it's just perhaps potentially a more efficient search engine at this point. But I don't think the AI itself would be in any way inherently evil per se.
I want to ask you a couple of questions. We have a little bit of time left, but
sure.
One, I'm going to preface it by saying, I grew up in a small town in western Pennsylvania, in Amish country, as a matter of fact, which would account for my bias against Amish people, but that's a separate issue.
I make the same joke. The Amish people, they used to steal my dad's mail, and he would always fuss about that.
Yeah, they do the craziest things. And they talk about you right in front of your face in that medieval German language. Anyway, in our little town, we had a very robust Orthodox community. The Greek Orthodox Church was the largest, but there was a very large, healthy Russian Orthodox Church, Antiochian Orthodox Church that was established in the 1920s by Syrian immigrants. It sort of became a church of converts. We had the Serbians, we had the Belarusians, we had a Bulgarian church, a Romanian church, 6, 7, 8 different Orthodox churches. Okay, that sounds great on the surface of things. But pan-Orthodoxy was something that just never happened in the town. Maybe a handful of Greeks would go to the Syrian Hefla and buy some kibbes and, you know, sit and have a drink. Maybe we would go to the Russian Christmas celebration. We always went to the Russian Christmas celebration. But otherwise, we didn't go to each other's churches. Maybe during Holy Week there would be an effort to get everybody together for, you know, a Lenten dinner or something like that. Is the idea of pan-Orthodoxy healthier today than it was 50 years ago? Or is this something that we've lost, we've missed? And why is it that the Orthodox churches are divided largely along national identity lines?
I think the ancient world, if you read the Council of Nicaea, you know, Canon 6 of Nicaea says that the different patriarchates and the different nation states kind of have their own modus operandi. So it just sort of developed, I think, naturally out of the history of the church that there would be ethnologically connected liturgies and confessions and styles of worship and understanding. So history is a huge part of that, and I doubt that it'll ever totally go away. But one thing I have noticed is that, like in my Russian church, when I first started attending there, it was me and a couple other English-speaking families and like 30 Russians. Mm-hmm. And now our church is probably 50 Russians and probably 70 English-speaking converts. So ironically, and it's very similar to, you mentioned earlier, the Antiochians, you know, that when I came into the church, it was through the Antiochians, and those are largely convert parishes. And so those tend to be amazingly diverse now. Yes. Because they chose to accept a lot of these converts. So it does exist. It's just kind of, with Orthodoxy in America especially, it's really wild. It's so random. It really just depends on where you go, and it's a kind of a Russian roulette as to what you're going to get, right? You don't know if you're going to get a totally, you know, Russian-speaking parish where if you're a average white dude or a black dude, you're like, I feel out of place here. I remember the first time I went to the Antiochian church in Florida, I was thinking, oh, this will be like the Antiochian church in Nashville, which is like all former Protestant Bible Belt people. And I go in there, I'm the only white dude, and the whole liturgy is in Arabic. And I'm like, okay.
And thank you for watching. This is The Deep State, and I'm John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.